Welcome to the Future Herd. I'm Jesse Hirsch. Today's episode asks a deceptively simple question. What does it take to build a sector that's truly ready for the future? Not a sector that reacts to pressure, but one that cultivates the mindset and cultural capacity to face uncertainty with confidence, curiosity, and imagination. My guest is Ruth Knight, a director with the Agricultural Adaptation Council and chair of their Agri-Food 2050 committee. In our conversation, she argues that foresight isn't just a planning tool. It's a practice of reconnection. It's the work of shifting how we think, how we listen, and how we create space for discovery. It's a move from control to emergence, from rigid problem solving to a more fluid dance between pragmatism and imagination. Ruth brings a perspective rooted in community development, rural planning, agronomy, and lived experience. She speaks to the power of dialogue, the need for psychological safety, the role of play and experimentation, and the moral responsibility to empower younger generations who will inherit a far more challenging landscape than the one we entered. If we want a resilient agri-food system, one capable of adapting, learning, and thriving in the decades ahead, we need more than strategies. We need a cultural transformation. And as Ruth reminds us, that transformation begins with mindsets shaped by patience, curiosity, empathy, and an openness to the unknown. Let's get into it.
My name is Ruth Knight, and I am a director on the Agriculture Adaptation Council, a very diverse agriculture and agri-food organization of over 60 members. And as a director, I chair the Agri-Food 2050 Committee. In my career, I have been an independent agronomist for the last 20 years, and I have always been passionate about agriculture and rural communities, and I'm also find it very important in terms of what is the future that I'm creating for myself and my communities and my future, our future generations.
What is it about this practice of imagining the future, of engaging in foresight, that you think is valuable, both for yourself, but also for the sector?
I think in terms of the process, I see it as an opportunity to have conversations, and in that conversation to allow various ideas, people exchanging their experiences and their perspectives. And I think that in itself will bring resiliency to our society, to our sector. And I think it's important that we appreciate that that process is necessary for us to reconnect. And then in the actual stepping into the future, we discussed earlier that it's a room full of leaders that are primarily really good problem solvers. And there may be a bias against ideation or big picture thinking. And so it simply comes down to creating the muscle to think about what you want as opposed to those things you don't want, and to be proactive in terms of this is the future that I would want to be in, as opposed to reacting, and in that reacting, getting really stuck, and also thinking that other forces beyond myself are in control.
And it certainly evokes the concept of we don't know what we don't know. And the opportunity for discovery in these types of process. For me, it's discovery of other operations, other farmers who I can learn from in terms of talking how they manage themselves. But to your point, it's also ideas. And ideas that may be new to people that prepare them for the future, that empower them for the future. So they see it as something to be excited about rather than be fearful about. How do we make sure there is that balance between the pragmatic and the theoretical, but between the problem solving and the need to kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, expand our minds so that we're ready for whatever the future throws at us.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a balance or a dance in terms of stepping into that future, in terms of the ideation and creativity and discovery. I think it's an internal process within ourselves, and that internal process then reflects in terms of how we connect to the external world. That's a significant reconnection in terms of we are of everything else. And so that it's a dance between the pragmatic and the discovery of, yeah, we don't know what we don't know. And collectively, we're a lot stronger in terms of addressing that unknown than spiraling down into, this is what I know from past, this is what I'm going to stick with. The getting unstuck into that really makes us vulnerable. And I think in that vulnerability, a lot can be achieved.
Right on. And I'm very much a believer in the role of vulnerability in innovation. And certainly in the tech sector, they had this phrase, fail early and fail often, as a way of hardening a startup to learn about their market, to learn about their technology, to learn about their area. And I love the notion of dance, right? That it is a kind of dance between the pragmatic and the theoretical and the problem solver and the ideas. What about the role of play? And the reason I'm sort of bringing in the play piece is, again, in the tech sector, there's a lot of play, both inside the enterprise and within research and development, where they're playing with technology, they're playing with ideas. What role can play have, both in the agri-food sector, but also within this process of imagining futures and preparing for futures?
That is really significant, and that's a part that we sort of leave behind when we step into adulthood, and also when we, it tends to be when we get more resources, we're more reluctant to sort of play around with them. We don't want to lose them, and you know, the demographic of the ag sector is in that stage of life, I guess, where a lot of that has gone through tough times and don't want to, you know, toss it all away. But, you know, a safe play is, and learning to stretch ourselves in play. Of course, it activates a different part of our imagination, and the imagination is so powerful.
And on the one hand, I think we're making the argument as to why we need more young people as part of the process, right? Because they bring a kind of imagination, a kind of questioning, perhaps tried and tested practices that we take for granted, that fresh eyes might have a way of innovating or improving. But even as we're discussing this, I'm imagining kind of role-playing games, you know, within a foresight exercise where you ask the farmer to play the producer, you ask the producer to play the role of the farmer, you ask the young person to play the role of the government. And again, just to get us thinking about other people's expertise, other people's perspectives, so that we broaden our sense of the future rather than narrow it. How do we, and here I'm being a little bit of a devil's advocate, how do we keep that play? How do we keep that kind of abstract element rooted in the problem solving that is what attracts many minds? Because what I found interesting at the event was that on the one hand, there are lots of people like you, like me, who think about policy, who think about culture, who think about the larger basket that all this happens in. But there are many who just want to focus on the bottom line, or they want to focus on, you know, making things more efficient. And so it strikes me the challenge is that inclusivity. How do you balance it so that all groups are kind of included and participating in this larger conversation about Ontario's food future?
Well, I think what we recognized in our process is we gained sort of solid ground with our peeps, our usual peeps, and then make others curious and create an invitation for them to come to the table. And there is a learning process in terms of future thinking as opposed to problem solving. And we sort of Okay, so that's what I like. And when we get into a safer space, we can have those conversations. And then invitational to new people. So it becomes iterative in terms of inviting that diversity. And with diversity in and of itself will create new perspectives. And but it's, you know, and it's a challenge in terms of people getting used to that outcome, that it's not a one and done, like, oh, well, we're going to come back to talking about that. So putting a fresh menu, setting the table a little bit differently in order for people to think that they have been heard. And I think it's very important that everybody is heard and we don't try to distill it down to, oh, we all got to get on the same page. Well, that's really a misnomer in terms of there are a lot of different ways to interpret a story and create a story.
Well, and it does strike me that there's an interesting tension between the desire for clarity and the desire to get everyone on the same page, because those were both recurring themes that I heard a lot. And again, I love your evocation of curiosity, because to me, that is central to the success of such an initiative, that it always piques people's curiosity, that they always feel that they're going to learn new things or be exposed to new ideas, even if it is practical and pragmatic. But there, I think, is a real need to maintain the diversity of ideas or even the respectful disagreement that happens in any community while still fostering a kind of unity. And where I think the clarity piece comes in is storytelling, like how we tell the stories about ourselves and our sector, because that is an easy way to maintain that diversity. I'm curious, what do you see as the story of this process? Because part of the reason I was really excited to talk to you is you've kind of had an insight into how this has been playing out. From a real diverse perspective unto yourself. Like, you're coming at this as an individual, but you're also coming at this as someone who wants to bridge different constituencies, who wants to bridge different stakeholders. And that's what I'm hearing in your language, is a desire to not alienate people, even though they might be in disagreement on certain issues. How do we maintain that balance? On the one hand, we've been talking about the balance between the abstract and the practical. But how do we maintain the balance between, say, the large operator and the tiny operator, between the large producer and the myriad of small producers? Because that's what excited me, is that it really seems like there's an appetite all around for, again, you use the word on the same page, which I'm not sure is possible, but no, in the same boat, right? Or in the same system, so that we feel a sense of commonality as Ontarians.
Yeah, in the same boat, for sure. I guess one thing that I pull out from what you said is language. And language is the primary way in which we are communicating with each other and sharing ideas. And so language is really important in terms of embracing new ways of expressing ourselves and allowing that space for people to show up and express themselves in different ways. And yeah, it's, I guess, where I felt at odds. So it's like, oh, I'm using a language and people are looking at me and going, okay, so then they say, well, what's the solution? And so I was throwing it out there and hearing it echo, but it not sort of catching on. And then it just takes time and patience sometimes. And then just say, well, I don't know what the solution is, but let's have a conversation and we can solve this together, because my solution to it is maybe not fitting to every situation. I my background in rural planning and development, I did a lot in terms of land use planning, but also in community development. And I've worked as an independent consultant working one-on-one and found the same thing over and over again in terms of, it's really about the mindset. And so how do we influence the mindset? And I think it's a more effective with, you know, peer-to-peers talking to each other in terms of helping people adapt their mindset and also to do it within some community context. So there's a sort of a communal identity. And when you say small producer, large producers, yes, that could be one, that's just one level of distinguishing differences, but there's so many levels that people have in commonality. And in commonality, hopefully we have some part of the future. And so what is it that we want that to look like? I have three young adult children who have been involved in agriculture, would like to continue to be involved in agriculture. And I see a great deal of challenges that I was never really aware of when I started farming and in being engaged in rural communities. And so really that's one of my driving forces, my driving passion, and not to think that it's going to happen in the next generation. It's going to happen in the next 5, 10, 25 years.
And I think your point about the mind frame or the attitude is essential. I think that's exactly it. You know, I often think of it as a kind of open mind versus the closed mind, that the open mind will be prepared for any future versus the closed mind will be terrified of all futures. But your point about your kids, I think, is also why I think it is so important, morally responsible even, that we start getting young people in power, because it is way harder for them. Like, yeah. Compared to, you know, myself, I know, let alone my parents, we had it tremendously easier than young people do today to get them to get on their feet, to get a business, to get a meaningful career. So I think that has to be, if we talk about the future, obviously we need to be thinking about those most likely to see it and help them with that. But you also said something that I thought I almost want to end with, and I've been giving you really hard curveballs here. As an interviewer, I really try to get the most out of my guests, and Ruth, you're excelling par excellence. But patience, I think, is really important, and that was something I thought you really emphasized well, and I want to tie that back to curiosity. Because it strikes me that if we could, within that larger mind frame we're trying to cultivate, if we could both nurture curiosity and patience, that affords a really excellent process of people who are committed, who are engaged, who are imaginative, and who are willing to see it for the long haul. Because you're right, it's not a one and done. And one of the provocations I was trying to make is, you know, every organization needs to take this process to their membership and make it as grassroots as possible so that we involve as many people as possible. So here's the billion-dollar question. How do we frame patience and curiosity? How do we kind of nurture the two of them within this emerging frame of mind that allows this process to really thrive and excel in the way that we think it can?
Oh, nurturing. I think it's this process of creating an invitation for people to have dialogue. And it's not a discussion or debate. It's a dialogue, and it is the best way in which we can communicate our ideas. So more and more opportunities for those dialogues to take place within an organization, between organizations, just creating that container. And there are some rules of engagement in terms of patience and curiosity and empathy. And yeah, bringing that as a organizational leadership strength. So leadership training in terms of the transformational leadership, who's empathetic. And I think that's in organizations, when you talk about organizations, I think that's a central part of supporting that type of leadership. Yeah.
Right on. Any final thoughts on either the process or where you want to see it moving forward?
Oh, I'm excited. And while there were a few, I would say, rough spots where I said, you know, people thinking that one, that, you know, on the same page or so, sorts of things, they're sort of rhetorical within our organization, and we just have to say, well, what are our basic assumptions about that? What does it really mean? And is that really how we want to operate? So I think when we really question some of those really basic assumptions and the way that we've been communicating ideas, I think that's important. And I think a lot of that has been sort of handed down in terms of maybe when government folks are trying to create policy in terms of their patients, in terms of there's really diverse ideas and, you know, a mandate in terms of how you write it, in terms of one piece can't really address all that. So we need a different approach to that as well. And so I've seen where there's, in creating policy, we really have there's a lot of conversations and there's a lot that gets distilled into that as opposed to a few expert ideas. And I think that's created policy that is reflective of the civil society, of all the different members and their diverse ideas. And by conversations, people find differences. It sounds very optimistic, but I think it's doable. And I think there are other cultures who have existed like this and who have gone through very big transformations and borrowing on their knowledge. And that was an important piece that I was really quite pleased about, that we had other knowledge keepers who came to the table and really had some really essential nuggets to share with us. Those are all different ideas that I think would be really helpful to bring to the table here.
Well, and to your point about other cultures, it strikes me that the ultimate mission is to change our own culture so that it's more resilient, so that it's more capable of dealing with the challenges that we face in our future. And that's no small task, right? That is a very sort of gradual, patient, curious process. And I think for me, the difference too is going from a system based on control to a system based on emergence, where you're just trying to create the right conditions in which the things you want emerge rather than try to control things to get what you want to emerge.
Yeah, it takes a lot more energy to control and keep things within set boundaries than to emerge and pivot and see where challenges are actually opportunities. Yes.
That was my conversation with Ruth Knight. What stays with me is her insistence that the future isn't something we predict so much as something we practice. The work begins in mindset, cultivating curiosity instead of fear, patience instead of urgency, and a willingness to let go of old assumptions in favor of something more open, more emergent, and ultimately more resilient. Ruth reminds us that dialogue is not an accessory to strategy, it is the strategy. When we create the conditions for people to listen, question, imagine, and disagree constructively, we strengthen the entire system. And when we broaden those conversations to include younger generations, small and large operators, policy voices, and knowledge keepers from different traditions, we begin to build the cultural capacity needed for the next several decades, not just the next planning cycle. If Agri-Food 2050 succeeds, it won't be because we found a single roadmap. It'll be because we invested in a culture that can learn together, improvise together, and adapt together. A culture that moves away from control and toward emergence. A culture that understands the future as a shared endeavor. Thank you for listening. If you're part of the agri-food sector or simply care about the food system we all depend on, I hope this episode encourages you to bring these conversations into your own organizations and communities. The future belongs to those who are willing to imagine it and to do the slow, patient, collective work of bringing it into being. We'll see you next time.